and welcome to Trippy Politics, Protests, and
Potpourri.
Today, our guest on the podcast is the Associate Professor of Community Psychology and Director of Research from the Homeless Research and Action Collaborative, Gregory Townley. Introduce yourself. Tell our audience what you do over there at the Homeless Research and Action Collaborative.
Sure. Thanks, Corey. Thanks for having me. So I'm the Director of Research at the Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative at Portland State University. You talked with our director, Marisa Zapata, last week, and she gave, I think, an overview of the research center. As Director of Research, really my job is to help people with their research applications, develop research agenda for the center, help people develop surveys, help people apply for funding, help with IRB applications, Institutional Review Board, and make sure that we are doing everything in an ethically sound way, and just to provide general consultation and support. I'm also leading a couple of our studies that I think we'll probably talk about, homelessness at Portland State and then also housing as healthcare. I'm a community psychologist, which means that I'm the type of psychologist that really cares about how our environments impact our well-being. It's not just our brains and things inside of us, but really things all around us, our social support networks, our jobs, where we live. And I've been studying and working in homelessness for almost two decades at this point.
Wow. You sound extremely busy. So I'm really excited to have you in here, especially after having Dr. Zapata and her study and exploring that one a little bit deeper.
It was amazing speaking with her. She was a wealth of information, especially with that new study that had just come out, counting 38,000 homeless people in this Tri-County area here in Portland back in, 2017? And we know that this housing crisis has only gotten worse.
Yeah, there's that study. There's a few more studies that I was kind of hoping to explore that you are actually doing right now. Me and you actually went, and so the Portland Street Response, I was actually taking part in that a little while ago, and then the team that I led out there into the Felony Flats area was actually a team that had you and another a reporter and a Street Roots vendor on it. I actually thought that was kind of cool. I would love to hear your take on that.
Please tell us about that.
Sure. It's really been an exciting opportunity to be involved in a local issue and make hopefully a high impact on this program that's really needed in our city. You've probably heard reports that in 2017, 2018, half of police arrests were homeless individuals, which is huge,
yeah, I've heard that.
Right? And so clearly, there is a need to have an alternate response and not have police always be the one that are going for calls that people are making, often these unwanted persons calls. And that word is something that really makes me uncomfortable, unwanted persons. But this is when someone may see someone sleeping, right, on the street or in their neighborhood. They call 911, right? And they say, there's an unwanted person, there's someone in my neighborhood, come and get them. And police don't need to be responding to those calls, because often what happens is they may run background checks, and they may have an outstanding warrant, it may be an opportunistic arrest. We really need to have an alternative approach, and that's where the Street Response comes. And Street Roots has been writing about this. I think they had an editorial piece in late 2018.
Yeah.
Then they had a breaking kind of special issue of Street Roots in March that really laid the groundwork for what this would look like.
I believe that piece was Emily Green.
Thank you. Yeah, Emily Green wrote, and then Joanne Zuhl, and then Kaya San all wrote on this, and it was informed by the CAHOOTS program in Eugene. And they wrote this model to kind of talk about what it would look like, who would be going on these calls. And then the city council approved a budget that would have $500,000, $500,000 devoted to a pilot program for Portland Street Response. And this falls under Commissioner Joanne Hardesty's office.
Okay.
And so in the summer months, what we've been doing is a variety of ways to get input from houseless folks and other key stakeholders around what Portland Street Response should look like.
And how are you getting that input? Is it just going out and speaking, doing the surveys like Corey mentioned he did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a few approaches. They're doing what are called listening sessions, where Commissioner Hardesty or others are going to places like Join, Sisters of the Road, Central City Concern. They're talking with homeless youth. And it's like a focus group style, where they have questions that ask, what should the model look like? How should first responders approach you? Who should be the first responders? What skills should they have? What resources should they bring with them? And we take that information to help inform the pilot. We also designed this street survey approach. Kaya San reached out to us. She knew that we had students working with us over the summer. And she had this idea of having students and vendors and other people with lived experience form teams of two or three and go out to streets, parks, shelters, and approach people and ask them if they'd be willing to talk with them. We developed a survey with Taya Kinshu from the Portland Mapping Action Collective. And we developed the survey to get a sense of, again, who should be the first responders, what should they, how should they approach people, what types of services, what do people need from the calls, when should police be present, when should they not be present. And we wanted to develop in a way that was like a conversation, not a really structured, standardized survey, but something that would be a tool for dialogue. So we developed a survey. We had training from Ibrahim Mubarak from Right to Survive. Yeah, and then Neil Sand, also from, he's from Yellow Brick Road.
Yep.
He and Ibrahim did a training for interacting with homeless people for students who maybe had not had that experience before, how to do it in a way that was really respectful of them and their humanity, and also looking out for safety and things like that.
So it's like a psychology first, empathy first approach.
Totally, yeah. And so we had these trainings. We went out in 2 days in mid-July, and each day teams, I think we had probably 20 teams, went out throughout the entire city, canvassed. And I was lucky enough on the Thursday to go with Corey, which was awesome because he had really insider knowledge about where to go.
You're right, because he has actually lived some of that before, unfortunately.
In that specific area that I think it was Ibrahim that was supposed to be leading that group that I volunteered to lead, but he was late or something. And I just threw my name in there because I knew that area.
Yeah.
I just didn't even know exactly who was going to be on my team, and you jumped in and then a few other people, so...
And you were such an awesome leader of that team, and you helped us, and really all of the vendors and people with lived experience. This project, the survey project, would not have been a success without you all. If it had just been me and other researchers and students going and trying to approach people and ask these questions, we would have had a really limited scope of who we reached.
Yeah, it was kind of eerie to me too when we showed up there, and like when we were still waiting for, I think it was Maggie Vespa from KGW, and like most of the people had already started walking up and started talking to me, and I was just like, oh, hey, hi guys. You know, it was kind of surreal for me because, I mean, that's my community. I know those people very well. And it was really heartwarming to see that doing the survey and having them approach us that easily was really going to be successful that day. And then we got around the corner, and they were in mid-sweep of the camps.
Yeah.
And that one was actually really heart-wrenching to me because it was just like, oh, well, we're not going to be able to get as many surveys done as I thought we were.
Yeah, both days, so like that was this kind of visceral experience that showed, again, the need for rethinking how we are responding to crisis calls involving homeless people. The fact that we had the rapid response there doing a sweep. On the Tuesday that I went, we were in St. John's on the Peninsula Trail, where there have been ongoing sweeps, including the Jason Barnes camp. The day that we were out, people, it was right after a sweep, so people were really raw and were really not in a place where our surveys were a priority, understandably, right?
Yeah.
One gentleman on the trail came toward me with a head wound. He had been maced, and it ended up being a domestic dispute in his camp. But the thought, like, he needed immediate, like, help, right? And so my immediate thing was like, we need to call 911. And I was like, wait a second, we're here exactly interviewing about an approach that would not involve the classic kinds of response that might end up being further traumatizing for this individual that's already really traumatized. And so it was kind of this feeling of like impotence as this researcher who, yes, I have a PhD, but I'm not able to like help this person who needs it right away. But hopefully with the information we're gathering, we will help develop and inform this response that down the road will be able to have a benefit for this individual.
It sounds like because this wasn't already set up and there wasn't already a system yet, you're just getting this off the ground. During that instance, if this had already been set up, theoretically, rather than calling 911, there would be a list of resource numbers, maybe a team at some of the nearby hospitals or somebody that you could call to check on these people's well-being.
Yeah. And hopefully right down the road, it would be a number they would be calling directly to Portland Street Response. Preliminarily, I think the initial plan is to still have them go through typical 911 channels, but then it would be triaged and then sent to Portland Street Response from there rather than, first, usually it's police and ambulance and fire, and the street response would be the fourth one down, and it would get moved there. But then hopefully they'll have their own number and their own way to directly call Portland Street Response in the future.
Well, as far as I understand it, a lot of fire trucks, they have you know, EMT certified personnel in there, which is why they go out so often to many of these calls.
Exactly.
You know, I can actually see it too from the regular citizen's standpoint when they have some, like a homeless individual, because I see it sometimes on campus over at PSU. There's one individual I know for sure goes up and he starts freaking out on campus, and I've watched CPSO get called on him multiple times, and I've watched him scare people, but he's in the middle of a mental issue, and mm-hmm. that's not the kind of stuff that police should be answering to. That should be the kind of stuff a crisis worker, somebody exactly. there to de-escalate the situation, somebody to reassure the people around, hey, he's just having an issue. It's handled. We're figuring this out. And to de-escalate. That's basically what needs to happen here.
I have to wonder about social training. I have to wonder that maybe part of the problem is that the average person, how are they reached and informed better about how to interact with someone? So when they do go to the grocery store and there is somebody outside begging for change that's not the kind of person they want to, you know, have tea with, how can they better help that person rather than make that person feel less than human yeah. by ignoring them? How can we reach the average citizen for them to understand this level of empathy? Because we talk about the sensitivity training, you know, with police, and the police going and handling these calls is part of the problem. And it's every individual officer is different. So it's not police per se, but some of their policies really don't help the mm-hmm. situation. But I would also say the average citizen isn't helping the situation either. Could you even see a way to reach people to help them better understand how to talk to an unhoused neighbor?
Mm-hmm. See, and this kind of goes, this in my mind, goes to some of the stuff that has been asked of me by other journalists is like, how do you approach these people? And the one way I see it is eye contact. A lot of people, the average person, just averts their eye contact the moment they get looked at by one of these individuals, and that's what a lot of these people get off put off by.
Well, with that, I would have to say privacy comes an issue, because you may make eye contact with someone with the intent of doing one of these surveys, getting their input, and it may be really good information that they have to share that could really help the system, but you make that eye contact and you've now put them in a vulnerable position, which is essentially what we're talking about, is how to overcome that step right there. Mm-hmm. I think then maybe sometimes the issue is how to recognize what is good eye contact and bad eye contact, how to read a lot of body language. I think there's a lot more to body language than eye contact. And a lot of times people can make that eye contact but still be forceful in nature
yeah.
because they are not reading that someone acknowledges your eye contact. If you looked at me and I look back, I'm acknowledging you. But if I then turn away, perhaps that means that I want privacy and I don't want to be approached.
Yeah. And it's being able to be, to understand what those cues are and how to see them. And I think one way that community members can really gain a better understanding of mental health is through like mental health first aid training, which is essentially a type of training where you learn a lot that a clinical psychologist would learn, but without going to, you know, a 6-year PhD program. And you learn about what mental health looks like, how to respond to someone, how to help people if they're in crisis, how to know like when someone wants you to approach them and when not to approach them.
No, I've never heard of that. I've definitely heard of first aid training back when I was a youth. I was in Campfire Boys and Girls, and we were all got CPR certified and we practiced on the dummies. But I've never heard of this mental health first aid. Yeah. Where could you find classes like that? Does it usually have a cost?
There are costs associated with it, but sometimes programs like, for example, Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare at the Garlington Center, which is an innovative housing approach where they house both people who have mental illnesses, but then they house them with people who are there through the city's preference policy. If they can show that they have family members who lived in Northeast Portland, and it helps them return to areas that they've been gentrified or displaced from. They also have people who are veterans. And so they offered, for individuals who don't have mental illnesses who are living there, they offer them free mental health first aid training so they would know how to interact with their neighbors. They would know if their neighbors are in crisis, what do they need to do. And so a lot of the mental health providers around the city have host these types of trainings. I can send you some links that you can make available on your website. But so this would be something to do, but also just really working with people to understand shared humanity. And I think that people so often distance themselves from homeless individuals because as a defense, right? Because so many people are more at risk for housing insecurity and homelessness than they may choose to believe. It's a defense to them that I could never be like that person, right?
I think there's
that
also...
That person's very different from me.
There's also that fear that says if I was then to engage with them, help them, become part of their circle, that they're going to drag me into their position.
Right.
Somehow they have that fear that instead of actually being able to help someone and lift them up to where they are, that they're going to get pulled down by sharing.
Yeah. And there's also the conflation of criminality with homelessness and that people just equate those two things. They think that a homeless person is automatically a criminal, right? That they criminalize basic behaviors like sleeping or a drug user or someone with mental illness when really the statistics show that for mental illness, it's around 30% of people who are homeless are experiencing mental illnesses, addictions. For if we look across all people experiencing homelessness, it can be as low as 20 if we include people that are in shelter, 20% in shelter or in transitional housing. It is higher for people experiencing chronic homelessness, and in those rates, it's typically around 26% for substance use disorders involving drugs, and then approaching 40% for addictions involving alcohol. But this is not like even half of all people who are homeless are mentally ill and addicted, which are these kind of stereotypes we have about the entire community.
The funny thing is when you start looking at those numbers, people start, what they remember, I should say, is the 40% number. 40% of the homeless have this addiction problem or that, right? But they're forgetting what the whole number was. Like, if there are 500,000 homeless people, it's 40% of that. Well, those 500,000 homeless people are still only a tiny sliver of the total population.
Right.
If you're to add them in with house, when you're talking about millions of people and you go down, it's not a lot of people that have this drug addiction problem, but there are a lot of people that are still unhoused without that problem.
Absolutely.
And that are having similar issues and that they could still be helped.
And see, me myself, I try and not separate out mental illness and drug addiction because drug addiction has been classified as a mental illness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they go hand in hand.
Sure.
In my mind.
Yeah, co-occurring disorders or dual diagnoses. Right, exactly. It's really important to think about them together. I think the last point in time count, I think among people who were homeless and unsheltered, I think it was 25% that said they had a dual diagnosis.
I believe that was the number that I read too. So, yeah.
And those individuals obviously do have complex challenges and needs that need to be addressed that are different than if you're, quote unquote, only dealing with a mental illness or only an addiction.
I mean, that kind of brings me into the other one that I wanted to explore, the survey out of you guys was... it was basically examining the different myths surrounded around homelessness, you know, how many people are addicted, how many people. So what other surveys are you trying to currently? Because I know I did some pre-testing for the student and faculty housing.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember all the questions off of that, but maybe if you can give a rundown of what that was.
For sure. Yeah, and if I could just close the loop on Portland Street Response.
Yeah.
So right now we're finishing up the data analysis for that, working on a report that'll be released mid-month, so mid-September.
Okay.
We'll release a report. There'll be a press conference. And the information, like I said, I think the power of that is that we went specifically to individuals with lived experience to ask what they think the model should look like. Because so often in policy conversations, they're left out of the policy conversations. All the decisions are made by people in power and without really thinking about the people who are going to be most affected by it. And so people really said, you know, there need to be mental health awareness. They need to be treated with compassion, with empathy. And I think that the quotes that are in this report will be quite stirring for a lot of people and will really add to the support the Portland Street Response has been from the community.
Now, we can go this a little bit further on the Portland Street Response because I do remember there being like some comments online after I had wrote like a self-reflection about leading that group.
Hmm.
And that got published. There was somebody who was asking, you know, is there going to be any feedback from, like, the general population, like the homeowners and stuff like that for the Portland Street Response of how they want to see it modeled? And it kind of leads me into the whole negative attitude towards the homeless here in Portland and how much is that going to affect it? Is there any real efforts right now being put forth to try and get the public opinion?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. I meant to mention that Commissioner Hardesty's staff have developed a survey that was online and it was sent to all neighborhood associations and all the business associations within neighborhoods, and they got a huge response rate of like 800 surveys back from individuals. Hmm. This is a web survey. I believe that they'll be summarizing this and it'll be available. But you're right, it's very important to get the perspective of houseless individuals, but without also talking to housed individuals, members of the business community, neighborhood associations. If they're left out of the process, that would be really bad.
Yeah.
Bad for public support of this program. And they got some good information, and information that is expressing, you know, of compassion and sympathy and wanting to make sure that we have something that will help individuals experiencing homelessness. There's also a lot of really negative stuff around, like, we don't want them in the neighborhood, the city is too soft on homelessness, and the typical things you hear.
See, and one thing that really bothers me, too, is the pushback the neighborhood associations give towards the city when it's trying to create these shelters. Mm-hmm. Like, there was one that was on 52nd Foster that was planned, then it was being pushed back on, and then it was back on to be planned out, and I don't even know where it's at anymore. And there's been a number of shelters I've seen that have tried to open in some of these different neighborhoods, and I kind of feel like it's detrimental to the situation when these neighborhood associations don't want these shelters, because the shelters would alleviate the neighborhood's problem.
Yeah, whereas they think that if you put it there, it'll just draw and attract houseless folks, and that it'll increase crime and all of this, that, and the other, when it's actually the opposite. It actually gives people some place to go. And some research that's been reported by sources like The Guardian shows that, you know, in this region, near the villages, crime rates actually drop. And it's because people actually, there's self-policing, right? People respect the area. They take responsibility. Exactly.
It's that kind of saying, like, you know, not in your own front yard sort of thing. You're not going to let that mess, you're not going to burn down your own front yard and let that crime happen right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was what are some of the surveys that you got coming out here in the near future? Because I know there was the pretesting I did for the student faculty.
When you say survey, I mean, explain for a listener who may not be as science-y or school-minded, is it just literally like a questionnaire? They're just different sets of a number of questions? Is there some special approach? Is there a theme?
Yeah, thanks for asking. It can be easy to get, like, speaking in jargon, assume that everyone knows it. But a survey in the classic sense is something that has what's called, like, a closed response choice, meaning that you have discrete or specific options to select from, right? And it becomes quantitative, meaning it's numeric. And so you have to have a question, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your stress level? And you can choose 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, 7, 8, 9, or 10. Or it might be something where the city is addressing homelessness in an effective way on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being strongly disagree, 5 being strongly agree, and you can answer anywhere in between.
And having answers like that is what helps you quantify that into those numbers and say 40% of people say they are severely stressed, you know, when they're living on the streets.
Yeah, then you ask a lot of people, and it can be a web-based survey that people do online or on their phones. It can be a paper survey where people fill in answers with pen and paper, and then you tabulate the results. You average across people.
Oh, sorry to interrupt. Yeah. Do you do phone surveys and all that stuff as well?
Yeah. And I've done door to door surveys where you canvass a neighborhood and ask if people will talk. I've done mail in surveys. Those typically have the worst response rates. People get it and they throw it away.
If they wanted to find out like what surveys you're currently running, kind of like Corey's asking, could they go to your website and see, hey, we're doing this survey in the fall of 2019 and we'll release it spring of 2020? Do you have somewhere that gives that information?
Yeah, like Homelessness PDX on Twitter is a good place to look. We're on Facebook, Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative. We have a website. I don't know that address at the top of my head, but if you Google Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative Portland State, it'll come up. So we have a variety of surveys, but then that's in contrast to an open-ended interview where you're talking to someone and the data there is text-based rather than numeric.
Well, this is kind of like this.
Yeah.
This interview.
Exactly. The interviews we did for the street response. And so we do both. We really value our center is very much into mixed methods and using whatever approach is going to be best for the research question we have.
How do you come up with those methods? Is it just like you and the director and the associate director, do you just get together and throw a bunch of ideas out and then pick one out of a hat? Or are there certain guidelines that you have to follow?
Yeah, there are definitely guidelines. And a lot of it, like I said, is based on the research question. So if you want really like rich contextual information, an interview or a focus group, somewhere you get words, is going to be much more effective than a survey where people are really limited in how they can respond. If it's a new and emerging area that there's not a lot of knowledge of, like the street response, it really needs to be open-ended and allow people to respond in whatever way makes sense for them. Down the road, as we get more standardized in this approach, we can use a survey that's more quantitative to evaluate it, right? To see what the numbers are, to see what percentage of people we're helping, how can we make it better? And so with the center, it really is based on whatever area we're working in. I use geospatial methods in my research.
And geospatial.
Create maps.
Okay.
Yeah, create maps of environments so we can see like where there are clusters of individuals experiencing homelessness so we know where to put services and resources.
I like maps. I like that.
Actually, I have a map of here of the where the Portland Street Response surveys were done.
Okay.
You can see where Corey and I were on 92nd and Division and 92nd and Flavelle.
Yeah, the 92nd Division one was kind of an odd spot for us because we went there second after 92nd Flavelle, and it had just been cleared where I had thought there was going to be the camps. And then once we got leaving from there, like we went up Division, I think it was, wasn't it? And then like right as we went to go turn around, we noticed that the encampment was actually on the backside of the highway, and it looked like it had just been freshly set up.
Yeah.
Wow, so, it looks like most of this is really all clustered around the downtown area, which is where, for as far as I understand it, most of the services are anyway. And then it looks like you have a number of places that you went out were mostly then by the 205 area, and then you have the one up there that you mentioned.
In St. John's.
So a little bit of everywhere, but still a lot of gaps
in the city. There was actually a master's thesis that was presented by a geography student not long ago out of PSU, and she was exploring what neighborhoods were mostly impacted by the homeless situation, which ones were more calls of unwanted people and all that, and it kind of showed like a lot of the hot spots are along the Max, the TriMet, downtown, I-205, stuff.
Like that 60th and Avenue Max station, those are like the two in the middle, and they kind of line up, the 60th and that 52nd Powell, when you're looking at the image that you have there.
Yeah.
And then the next cluster is all along that 205. So there's a lot of like areas in the city that have yet to get information that you're just itching probably to go out and talk to people to get some more data.
Yeah, we won't be able to go everywhere, but our hope is also that we started to hear a lot of the same information from people, and so our thoughts are that we likely can generalize this information to other areas, but it is also why we've done these other listening sessions, these other approaches. These spots were actually selected based on the point of contact maps where sweeps were going to happen. And so we thought that those would be particularly important places to go, and also informed by experts like Corey, who suggested where we should go. But back to the center and our research, I'll talk about two projects that I think will also help the listeners get a sense for how we do research and how we understand what types of questions to ask.
That would be excellent. Please.
The first is a study that we're doing that we did over the summer at Kenton Women's Village, where we interviewed residents of that village, all of whom were female identified, about their experiences moving into the new site. So Kenton Women's Village recently moved in the spring, just down the block, still in Kenton.
I just literally went out there and I was like trying to figure out where it was and where it is now. And it was like, wait, this is literally a half block from its former site.
Right. So. And then in that former site, there's actually an innovative affordable housing model that's going to be implemented over the next year and built. So then we work with architects. So like Todd Ferry on our team has been really integral into helping to develop a few of the villages. He's worked with Hazelnut Grove. He's worked with Clackamas Veterans Village and Kenton Women's Village. And what we eventually want to do is help all the villages kind of understand what's working, what can be improved, and do evaluation across the villages to inform a how-to guide for how villages can be developed and operated. And so we did interviews with 75% of the residents at Kenton Women's Village, and we did a combination of both surveys that were, again, like numeric, and asking them questions on a scale of 1 to 5. How much do you like your pod? How much do you like the village? How much do you feel welcomed by neighbors? And they can answer in a kind of a structured way. But a lot of them really had a lot of rich information they wanted to share beyond these really like structured questions. And so we did follow-up qualitative interviews where they could really talk and elaborate. And from these, we got all sorts of excellent ideas about how to improve villages, the gaps, what's working, what isn't working. And we're analyzing these, and we'll be presenting them at a Portland State of Mind event on October 10th at the Native American Student and Community Center from 4 to 6.
Nice.
A little plug for our event. And then they also help us get pilot data, which is basically data that you get on a small scale before going larger with your research.
Okay.
And so we'll see what worked well in the research before we do the same research at other villages.
Now, I know PSU has been involved, especially Todd, and hopefully maybe sometime in the future we'll have Todd in to talk about working with and designing some of the pods and working with the villages. But I know that PSU is involved with quite a few of the villages. Do you know which ones specifically?
Yeah, so Todd and his team with Hazelnut Grove, with Kenton Women's Village, with Clackamas Veterans Village, some I think with Agape.
Okay.
Let's see. We've certainly known of and been in contact with Right to Dream 2, with Dignity Village, but not as intensely as the others.
Okay. So, yeah. Right to Dream 2 and the one Dignity are the ones that you're kind of just mostly talking with and figuring out what's going on,
mm-hmm.
but haven't really worked with the pod building there. So, yeah, that would actually probably be more for me to bring up with Todd about further. So one of the surveys that you guys actually had coming out of the center was examining, like, the myths and all that, and it was really interesting to me because I started to try and answer the questions, and I ended up with, like, a 90% on the test because I underestimated the support of the city in the form of beds that were provided. And I found the questionnaire to be very interesting because, you know, it examined how many homeless might have had a drug issue and all that, and I found that one really interesting. I don't know if you were the one that was writing that one or if you helped with that one, but there was like a bunch of questions. I can't remember them off the top of my head that they explored.
Yeah, so Stephanie Knowlton, our communication specialist, who's awesome, was really integral in doing research to inform that Mythbusters campaign. And she and Dr. Zapata worked really closely on that, along with others, to get that information out there and to really help people start to challenge their assumptions. And the item that you missed was the most missed of all the questions. I missed the one around addictions because I answered it according to my thinking of people who are chronically homeless rather than across all homeless individuals. So I think it was a really effective project. Now, to go back for the other survey, which is homelessness at Portland State.
Yeah.
This was one of our big initiative areas for when we first formed, that we knew that in order to be able to address homelessness anywhere, we first need to be able to address homelessness on our own campus.
I think that's what Marisa was mentioning as well. Yeah, she had talked about the number of students and that security had mentioned, or just people that were in the parking lots hanging out, that were using the buildings and facilities, bathrooms, that were homeless, and realized, like, we need to get some information on this in order to do anything.
Exactly, yeah. We are going to be doing surveys of students, of employees, and we'll also be doing a variety of research to address the experiences of community members who are on our campus who may not be students or employees, but they're still experiencing homelessness and in need of help. And our university, being a public access institution, should be helping the individuals, not just locking up doors and saying, you can't come here.
Through the Vanguard, there has been some stories that have been, like, ran past me, of, like, is this a valid one? Like, people down in the bottom of the basement of Smith Memorial Student Union hanging out in the bathrooms, giving themselves essentially what's known as a horse bath in the sink and stuff like that because they have nowhere else. And a lot of this stuff does go reported into the, like, the weekly interactions and stuff like that, the crime blogger, but it's stuff that's very disheartening that this is kind of stuff that's happening on campus. A lot of people are scared of it.
What surprises me is the common sense of something like that. Like, people are upset that someone is using a bathroom, which is a hygiene facility, for hygienic purposes.
Right.
So they may be in there for 10 or 15 minutes, but they basically just rushed through getting their body clean so that they could be in acceptable to society. Like, that shows that somebody has a desire to fit into society. Why are we shaming that? Why do we want to write stories and lock up bathrooms and make totally valid citizens, you know, embarrassed for asking to use a bathroom somewhere because they have to get a key? And the, you know what
right.
I mean?
Totally.
And now
yeah.
you might be judged, like, honestly, as someone who I drive around a lot, you know, as a freelancer, I got a lot of things going on, PCC student. But so I'm driving around a lot, and there's no public bathrooms at a certain time of the day. The parks are closed. And if you just stop somewhere and go in to use the restroom, people look at you differently. They treat you differently. If you aren't there to spend money, they're kind of cruel about it. Like we were talking earlier, they want to ignore you. They don't want to make eye contact. They aren't as friendly with that social chit-chat. People are unfortunately a little too judgy, and I think that's really keeping everyone from making progress.
Yeah. People need to increase their distress tolerance, right? People have so low of a bar for what they deem to be behavior that is not something they can tolerate, right? And so they, rather than kind of thinking about, like, what are the times when I've really needed to use a bathroom and not been able to, and rather than applying that to the individual that they are, you know, upset about seeing, they call CPSO, or they overreact, or they go online and start, you know, saying we have to get all the homeless people out of our campus, right? So I think that it's just, again, about compassion and humanity and being able to tolerate behaviors that may seem abnormal but that are survival, right?
And on that note, I have actually this past week run into odd circumstances where I'm just by myself in my vehicle because, like I said, I drive around a lot. I'm always moving around. And so I'm sitting there, and I was watching Democracy Now while, you know, having a cigarette break after eating some food, was chilling in a neighborhood, you know, trying to cross town, taking a break. And it just, I was legally parked and stopped. But I had the police were called on me while I'm just sitting there minding my own business. I'm not making a ruckus. I'm all by myself. There's nothing going on. This is not a rundown vehicle. And even if it was, that just says that, you know, I'm struggling. But it kind of amazes me. And that wasn't my only incident. And that's just this week. And so I actually had one this morning. I called my co-host here. And said that I have to call someone and tell someone this is the most mind-blowing thing. I was just sitting here, literally just sitting here minding my own business. I think it was about maybe 2 hours roughly I was on that spot because I had some time to kill, you know, trying to get across town before I made it here for this interview today. And next thing I know, there's a police officer at my window. And I didn't know he was there until he says, hello. And I just turned my head and my eyes got big and I said,
oh, jarring.
Hi. And he said, hi. So we got a call from a neighbor saying that there was someone out here screaming and yelling and this has been going on for a long time and they're afraid. That is what I was told by a police officer simply because I was present in my own private vehicle minding my business. I'm on my cell phone. And let's be honest about the kind of world that we're in today. How many gig employees do you see driving around? You've got those Instacart shipped workers. You've got Caviar, Grubhub, Postmates, DoorDash. I mean, keep going down the list. How many delivery personnel do we have? And all they're doing is they're spending all day in the car.
Yeah.
And they have to, what, stop in neighborhoods after making deliveries,
right.
Stop near stores after making deliveries. They have to find a bathroom. They've got nowhere else to go. If you're chasing a story as a reporter, you're going to be on the road for hours. If you're out doing research on the other side of the city, you're out and about for hours.
Yes.
And these are totally valid things that the average citizen, I think, can identify with. That's going to school, going to your job, just being a member of society that's participatory and functional.
Yeah.
And yet, us individuals that represent those functional people still are dealing with the same kind of responses that people in very obviously destitute circumstances are dealing with. People that are in PTSD crisis scenarios that have nowhere to go. They have a tent for today until it's swept.
Yep.
And then they have to worry about starting over. And people forget or have no idea because they've never been through it what it's like when you are in a survival first mode.
Right.
This is why I think the mental health approach that says housing first is huge, because from my understanding, it seems like the reason that people can't even grasp this concept is because they've never been pushed to such an extreme level of survival. No matter how stressful or, you know, overbearing whatever circumstances were in their life, they always had someone to turn to. They had somewhere to go. They had a resource. They had maybe, even if it was $50 in the bank and a friend to pay for a meal, that got them through. Where a lot of people that are in a tent in this situation, they got to that point. There was that moment. And when they looked around, there was nobody. And they didn't have that money in the bank. And they didn't have that meal. And then they had a bad night's sleep. And it becomes a cascading reaction. It becomes a vicious cycle that never stops.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of glad you brought that up. I was kind of trying to avoid that topic and that story. But it kind of brings me into the whole profiling, the whole assumptions of what these people are dealing with. Like, it seems to be the moment somebody in this city sees somebody that's homeless and on the streets, they think they're drug addicted.
Or if they see someone who happens to have objects in their vehicle because they're a traveler or adventurer or a freelancer, and I might just, when inspired, you know,
start writing
wherever I'm at, because I don't want to lose that information, and I can't wait an hour to remember all the amazing stuff.
Right.
I got to get it out, and I can just pull on over. I can do it on my phone, transfer it over. But next thing I know, I've got a police officer called on me because I'm there. So,
and because someone didn't have the decency to come ask you, like, do you need anything? Like, is everything okay?
There was one morning where someone did do that, and it was exactly that scenario. I had been inspired and said, I've got to just stay right here and write, or I'm going to lose this. So I pulled out my laptop, and I started writing like a mad woman. And this neighbor came out, and there was the lovely banana mutt. Nothing involved.
Yeah.
It was very nice. I think she was, confused at first as to why there was a person there, but she stopped. She took the moment to use her eyes and her mind and assess the thing right in front of her, and just realize it's just a person. It's just a person that happens to be right there on their laptop in a vehicle. And she brought me a muffin and said, hi, how you doing? I'm going to make sure everything's okay.
Yeah.
I said, I'm great. I'm just a freelancer, reporter, and a college student, and I needed to write. So I'm writing right now. I hope you don't mind. And she said, no problems. I just want to make sure everything's okay.
Yeah.
So I remember one of the surveys that was through the PSU HRAC was talking about how, like, it's 17% to 22% or something like that for percentage of college students that might be experiencing some form of unhoused or unstable housing.
Housing insecurity is what they're calling it.
Yeah, let's go back to that project and real quick on that, just to close the loop. You know that 25% of the calls to 911 are for exactly what someone called you on? That
unwanted
kind of, like,
person.
Unwanted person.
And I have experienced two in the last 7 days. I've experienced two in the last 7 days, and the officers were quite embarrassed, and they left rather quickly. They realized that was a waste of their time. On one of those calls, there were two different vehicles involved.
Such a waste
That's
of time.
Vehicles and officers and time, and I couldn't help but think, I told Corey this morning, just hours ago, I said, this is embarrassing about the fact that there is someone right now in the city of Portland that is calling 911, that is calling for police officer, that is terrified for their life, that is afraid of something, that needs real help.
Mm-hmm.
And this officer is coming to say good morning to me.
Yeah. It's another reason we need the Portland Street Response. So then with the survey at Portland State, so nationally, research around student homelessness and housing insecurity and food insecurity has been a topic of increased attention in the last several years. Starting with studies that were done at California State University from Dr. Rashida Crutchfield, who is on our research advisory board, which is awesome, and Dr. Jennifer McGuire, Hope Center at Temple University, led by Dr. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, and then also a recent study at NC State University led by Dr. Mary Haskett. NC State's actually my undergraduate institution, and so I was excited to see that they were doing this work, and we used all of these as models for the survey we're doing. The numbers across these studies converge that around 10 to 14% of students are homeless, and then around like 30 to 40% are housing insecure.
When you say students, are we talking like kindergarten to high school? Are we including college?
Here we're just talking about college.
Okay.
Yeah, just college students for this research.
In college, that includes basically 18 to 35 years old, or does that have a larger?
Anyone.
Any age, 15 up is roughly?
We start at 18, though. And with research, it's really difficult. It can be difficult to do research with people who are under 18 because they can't sign consent. They need a guardian consent. And so we are starting with 18 as the – we'll miss a few students, but not a lot. And then any students – and PSU has a lot of non-traditional students and older student body.
Right.
So we'll have students across the lifespan, online students, in-person students, part-time, full-time. And – so for homelessness, the scales include both like the HUD definitions of the more kind of classically like literally homeless, but then they also include Department of Education data around living doubled up. the housing insecure questions are things like, have you had a hard time paying your rent or your mortgage? Have you needed to move in with someone else temporarily? We're asking questions about, have you needed to sign up for, to enroll in student loans, sign up for classes just to get student loans to pay bills, right? Because a lot of students are doing that where it's again, survival, right? They're taking out massive amounts of
and
loans.
They believe that once they have the college education, they're going to be able to make that money back.
Right.
That's part of the problem lately with college loans.
That and the increased costs of tuition, of housing, all of these create kind of the perfect storm for college students really struggling, and it impacts their academic success, it impacts their health, their well-being. So we've developed this survey that'll go to students, but importantly, it'll also go to employees. And to our knowledge, this work hasn't been done. We focused on students on college campuses, but not staff, faculty, because we also know that a place like Portland, they're also many of them are also struggling to pay bills, and we want to know what their rates of housing and food insecurity are.
It seems like the staff would be in a great position. You know, a lot of the professors who get to know their students to offer suggestions about how to find or reach some of these students to understand what their needs are, because I'm sure these professors are hearing it from the students themselves.
Yeah, we do. We see it in our classes. What inspired me to want to do this work was actually seeing students sleeping outside of my office in the morning when I go. I'm in Kramer Hall, and I noticed as the years went on, like more and more students I was seeing were sleeping on campus. More students in classes were disclosing experiences of homelessness, and it's so hard for them to. I mean, they are amazingly resilient and end up doing really well in classes, but it's much harder for them than the students who are permanently housed and who aren't struggling with those same financial needs.
Which makes you wonder how well they could do if they had that bit of stability.
Exactly.
When you have a student that might be on a dean or a president's list with a really great GPA, you know, mostly A's, how much better could they do? How much faster could they achieve their goals if they didn't have this one obstacle? Because there's a lot more involved, like you're just saying, the mental health of it, but there's the privacy involved to do the studying, the place to plug in your laptop to actually get your homework done, because you can't sit in public and get Wi-Fi everywhere. You know, school is one of the few places that you can do that. And when they don't have anywhere else to go, they're sitting on campus. They're sitting in the buildings. That's why the libraries, at least at my school, I'm at PCC, is way more full than I remember it. But I've seen a big change as well. The same things that you're mentioning, that there are people not just in the buildings, but definitely cleaning themselves up in the bathrooms. In many of the buildings, you have people sleeping, bringing all their stuff and hanging out all day because they have nowhere else to go.
There's also reports of drug use in some of the bathrooms on PSU campus as well.
The reality is that's everywhere. You've got to worry about that in Starbucks and Burger King. You got to worry about that everywhere. You got to go.
And I kind of brought it up with Dr. Zapata when I was talking about how, you know, it's kind of adds up to the whole there's no housing for these people, and when you have no house, you have no place to hide the skeleton in your closet.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's partially the issue as well as to why people are so uncomfortable as soon as they see someone, because you can go home and you can clip your toenails and sweat and look funny and spread out and belch
and get,
do these
and
things
get and get butt naked if you
and
wish.
You have that privacy to just express and let it out and to reset, or just stare at the wall if that's all you want to do. Go totally Vulcan, because I'm a Star Trek lover, and just meditate if that's what you want to do. You can't do that when you're forced to live in public. If someone wants to spend 3 or 4 hours in a quiet space so that they can get calm and get focused and get on task, everybody is going to disturb that person. You've got vehicles driving by. Doesn't matter if they're in a tent or if they're living in a vehicle, or if they're on someone's couch, you have everyone else's life that's going around them is now become their environment. They have no control over how to cultivate the elements of their environment they need. And that's part of the daily struggles I think these people are spending every day, literally trying to find a quiet spot. If I can just find one place where nobody talks to me for 8 hours, I can sleep. Things like that are what's going through their head when someone tries to go and talk to them and say, hey, no one's realizing what's going through that person's head.
That's a really interesting perspective. I mean, all the things we take for granted.
I've gone up to Jason Barnes Landing, and I've spoken to a variety of people in a lot of places, but up there I've been regularly recently. And I've asked them, you know, do you have a phone or something? It's very rare to find someone that does have a phone. Or if they have one, that it's in service. Most often it's one of those by the minutes, pay as you go. Mm-hmm. Because it's affordable, it's budgetable. These people know how to budget. They know how to make something stretch. But it's still, it's not allowing them the basic access. Like, the internet is one of the most common resources that I think people need in order to get back into society. That's on top of privacy, you need access, and they don't have access.
Right.
So not only are they, every time that they try to find privacy, when they have a problem with that, or they try to express that or stand their ground or state a law or ask a question, they have no way to even record that or to reach out to somebody or get on the internet and say, you know what is that law? Let's look that up together, officer. Then we'll both know, and we're going to agree on whatever this internet tells us. You know, and they can't even make solutions in the moment because of the kind of situation that they're living in. So when people walk up and have expectations of these unhoused people, why are you sleeping here? Why are you in my space? Why do you smell funny? Why are you spending 20 minutes in the bathroom?
Yeah.
A lot of these things are not really taking into accountability what it would be like.
Something that makes me think of is that for the individuals with phones, so often you hear then from community members like, oh, well, if they can afford a phone, why can't they X, Y, or Z? And like in this day and age, like phones are basic like survival in a lot of ways. Like what can we do without our phones? And when I see, like I remember driving to campus one day and I saw a gentleman waking up in the morning on a bed mat and he had his phone, he was looking at it. And what I took from that was like, wow, that's such like a something that connects us. The first thing I do in my morning, I look at my phone. In the morning, I look at the phone, I look, check the weather, whatever. And this gentleman was doing the same thing. But how many community members would rather than seeing that point of connection, and that is someone who's just starting their day, they think of like, why do they have the phone? They don't deserve the phone. Like the things, yeah. the deserving.
Just guessing, you have to wonder if that goes back to the fear that these people have. They have to set themselves apart from the unhoused because they're afraid that if they engage with them or allow them in or help them, that they are going to be in the same situation, that they only see this as a one-way road that goes downhill. They have a hierarchical mind about it, and it's us versus them.
Yeah.
And they have to stay distinct. So if they see these markers that make it more human, if they see that person that struggles, that's crying, and then all of a sudden it actually forces them to check their own reality, because now they're having a moment where they may have to put themselves in that person's position, and that could be utterly terrifying.
Yeah.
Whereas it might be a bit of a defensive technique to say, I can't empathize with them because they made this choice. It's not something that happened to them. It's something they're doing to themselves. They're wasting their money on the cigarette addiction rather than going in and spending, you know, saving $200 a month for rent when you can't even get an apartment unless you're making at least
$2,000. Yeah.
And so you brought up a topic right there that I was kind of talking to Greg earlier before even the podcast was addictions and
coping mechanisms.
Mechanisms and the fact that meth has overtaken the popularity of what she's being used as most on the street drugs, actually. And
I don't know much about that. I just know that that's always been a problem for a long time. For decades, I've been hearing about methamphetamines.
Well, for quite a while, it was actually opiates that was the most common.
Well, opiates is what I understand has been the new, more burgeoning crisis because of, like, opiates was huge when everybody was prescribing. Like, that was what all these lawsuits are about, these companies and the family that runs pharmaceuticals. A lot of lawsuits against that because of the opioid crisis. They were not being responsible in the way they were marketing this stuff. They outright lied in some cases to get contracts to get their medicine pushed out. And then people got addicted to it and couldn't afford it. So I know some laws were changed to make it harder to get those drugs because of this opioid crisis. And the reality is people couldn't afford these drugs. So because they couldn't get that type of opioid, they went to a much cheaper street alternative known as heroin or black tar.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been hearing about on the news in the last few years. That's been the serious rising crisis. That for decades it's been methamphetamines. Everybody knows about Breaking Bad, that sort of phenomenon that went on. And that's been sort of supplanted by heroin use because of the severe opioid epidemic. And it actually becomes a severe mental and physical issue because your body is degrading while you're alive, and it puts you through extreme pain. And so I've looked into it a little bit. So it puts you through crazy pain, and these people can't think. They literally, their brain is not able to process. It does not function. It's a problem.
Yep.
It's a medical problem.
See, I wonder if those laws are the reason, because Greg was just sharing with me what he was discovering, and that it is meth that is actually overtaking heroin as the most popular street drug. Now,
see, and I haven't heard that yet.
And the most dangerous. So in 2017, in Multnomah County, homeless deaths linked to meth rose to 46%, with opioid deaths dropping to 41%. And this is quite different from 2014, where 22% were from meth and 61% from opioid use. And they don't know exactly why this is, but some of it's attributed to improved access to naloxone,
the
drug that can reverse the opioid overdose.
And there's another, there's a couple
there's
others, like
some,
there's a few other versions of that that the medical community uses, I believe, to treat that addiction, like Suboxone is one, and then I think there's one with like an F.
Yeah,
there's fentanyl.
Fentanyl, because fentanyl is something that has also been linked to this opioid and addiction crisis, that people that are overwhelmed, they have not learned the social, emotional, and mental processes or skills throughout their life to cope with their environment and their built life around them kind of dissolving when the housing crisis happened, when food insecurity happened, they lose their friends, their support circle, and they're faced with a life on the streets. Many people have, unfortunately, turned to these drugs. And I think what you were saying is that the change could be because of these laws.
There's also
changing access.
There's also a number of other things that I've noticed personally that have driven this trend, and that is like a crackdown locally on meth cooks in different counties around and in Multnomah, and an influx of more potent meth coming out of like the I-5 drug corridor from Mexico. I think you were also talking about how it's becoming more potent and more affordable and more pure.
Yeah. I think that's the sort of border issues that we should be worried about. We want to worry about anything at the border. It should be the things that are coming in that are honestly killing people and drugs. Those serious drugs are actually killing people. Not just like actual like loss of life. I mean, they're killing people while they're alive. We have walking zombies on our streets. People that don't have the skills or the tools in their toolbox to get themselves out. And unless we create some tools that help these people reach out of this pit of despair they're sitting in, they're going to get stuck there and they're going to get left by the wayside. And that we're seeing that as becoming a bigger problem, because every year these numbers are growing. They're not going down.
Right.
And so going back to the survey for the students and faculty and employees with PSU. What kind of results are you maybe expecting from that? And like, what kind of policies or what do you hope to maybe that will inform?
Yeah, so we have a survey that we're finalizing. It'll be on Qualtrics, which is an online survey platform. All students will get a link to complete the survey. It'll go out in the first week of classes, and they'll have 4 weeks to complete it. Same with employees. And I appreciate the insight you gave on the survey, Corey. Corey was really helpful in reviewing an early draft and had a couple suggestions that were just really key, one of which was asking if people had to sleep on campus because they had nowhere else to go. Mm-hmm. And the other one was just asking an open-ended question at the end if there's anything else they want to share about their housing experiences. And I think that's really powerful to allow people to provide that, and that'll give us a lot of insights into things we might have missed in the survey. And so thanks again for doing that.
Oh, of course.
We will... We expect that our numbers will likely be similar to these other institutions. I think that ours will probably look more like the community college numbers, which are slightly higher than the four-year institutions.
Okay.
Given that Portland State has a lot of transfer students, a lot of commuter students, non-traditional students, I think our profile often ends up looking more like kind of in between a community college and a four-year institution.
Do you have a lot of housing on your campus?
We don't.
We have no housing.
We have dorms, but not a lot. And there aren't a lot of students living on campus, but...
And the cheapest dorm set up in campus is like for a single studio's $900 a month, and for like a
two-bedroom. Cheaper than the rest of the city. When I looked up studios, it was pretty cheap to find a $1,000 studio in the city.
And I'm also wondering, you know, exactly how much. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
Maybe this will bring it back. You asked about policies and what changes we want to make. We don't want just the numbers so we can say, hey, this is where we're at. We want it to be able to inform a strategic plan for how we address housing insecurity on our campus. One of that could be building student housing, but I think more importantly, we need to think about leveraging relationships with like the Portland Housing Authority to find ways that students can maybe tap into vouchers or empty units and not have it be something where it's only based on campus, where the cost of living downtown and the real estate to build housing downtown is going to be a lot. And so
I think getting it done timely as well for a student, because when you have up here, you have quarters. And so if a student realizes like the week before term starts or the week that classes start, they realize I don't have a place to live this week. They need a place to live within a week or two, or the rest of the term can just go downhill. They'll never quite recover. They'll make that bad impression with the teacher that first week. They're unable to get their school supplies, or they lose their things. Maybe their stuff was stolen. It gets a lot harder.
That brings me back to exactly what I was trying to think of a second ago. And it was kind of, do you think that the campus might actually like benefit from a lower income dorm? Or also because we're in the downtown corridor and we get some of the homeless that actually come up to campus or live on the border of campus, if the campus might benefit from an actual resource center?
Why don't we have more hostels in this town? I feel like PSU is a kind of a great place to have that in between hostels, since you have such a diverse group of people that use PSU.
Yeah. No, I would love a mixed-use, low-income housing that wouldn't just be for students, but also community members who are struggling with housing needs. And this would be, I think, something that on the bottom floor, having like a housing resource center, a homelessness resource center. There are models around the country. I think Berkeley recently opened a housing and homelessness resource center for students. Other groups have done it. I think it's something that PSU has resources on an individual basis, but not a place like a one-stop shop where students can go.
I mean, I know there for some students, if there's a financial struggle, there's like a $500 student loan.
Hardship, emergency loan.
But
right,
I mean,
the loan comes out of your financial aid, was what I understand.
These hardship funds can be used for anything, and they don't have to be paid back.
There's grants that don't have to be paid back, but a loan is different because PCC has something like that.
Okay.
But it's different that they're only offered a few weeks after a term starts. You have to kind of know where to look. They're buried a little bit to find the grants. But usually the loans are offered first to say, look, you can get maybe $200 out of your next term. So it's kind of like, what's that phrase? You're stealing from one hand to feed the other, kind of a deal.
Yeah.
I'm taking from next term to get me what I need to pay rent this term.
See, the emergency fund I was talking about was actually, it's an emergency fund that students can tap into. I think can pull $500 for a term and has to pay back by the end of term. Mm. I didn't know about the hardship grants. How would a student find these? How would they access them?
Yeah, so if you look up hardship funds through PSU's website, you can find them. Unfortunately, they run out really quickly, not surprisingly, and they vary by colleges. So the business school has a large endowment that allows them to have more of these available than like College of Liberal Arts and Sciences.
Okay.
We also have been working, there's a student working with us who is interested in safe parking initiatives, and we've even been thinking about the role of safe parking on campus. We know that students are buying a parking spot because it's less to a month to buy that. It's like $120 as opposed to rent, which is, you know, $1,000+, and they're living in their cars, right? So let's have a place where they can do that in a sanctioned way and not have to worry about constantly having to move the car, worry about getting a ticket or a citation, allow them to use
the bathroom.
Where
they can stay overnight because they are a student. They're part of that.
So what studies are you guys coming out with in the future?
Lots. Always lots in the works. I mean, we would love to. We have a lot of So like Lisa Hawash with social work is really expert at looking at hygiene needs and hygiene centers. And we're going to be hopefully doing some surveys with houseless individuals to understand what their hygiene needs are and use that to inform the development of a strategic plan that hopefully the city would use and benefit from around hygiene needs. We have, like I said, the village work that we've been discussing. I'm working with a variety of local housing providers on a grant that would look at the use of individualized services in housing and look to see, like, what role could we do in tapping into Medicaid dollars that are usually only used for clinical and health services. What can we actually use Medicaid dollars for to tap into housing needs, giving someone pointers on how to pay their bills, how to cook, how to find community activities to attend. All of these are things that have health benefits and help keep people stable in housing, and we need more of them. We need to know how those individualized supports can be paid for by federal dollars or state dollars to enhance people's housing stability. We are doing a lot of work around narratives around homelessness, how people think and feel about homelessness, reading things like Nextdoor, reading things like the Point of Contact, the maps that people, where people can report camping and what they say about that, understand how people are talking about homelessness so we can understand ways to change their thoughts and feelings toward homelessness, to hopefully change their actions around voting, volunteering, donating money. So there'll be a variety of studies in that area. There are more. I'll stop there.
Actually, I would love to talk to you for even longer, but like we're slowly
at time, huh?
We're running out of time.
We've actually been talking to you for an amazing hour.
Great.
Already. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you.
I want to also ask if you would quickly state the website and where people can go, just so that people can get in more information on some of what you mentioned today. Of course, you are the director of research for the Homeless Research and Action Collaborative.
That's right.
At PSU.
Yep.
And you are also the associate professor of communication psychology.
Of community psychology.
Community psychology. Sorry.
That's right. And people can find us on Twitter at homelessnesspdx. It's https://www.pdx.edu/homelessness-collaborative-.
Wow.
So, and also if you Google Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative, you'll find us. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
I have seen you on the Facebook for sure. Definitely.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. And thank you, our great listeners. And this has been Trippy Politics Protest.
And Potpourri.
KBOO Portland. Ooh.